it's really easy to fail in life, and really those failures are opportunities to learn from your experiences, and you know they're only going to hold you down as long as you let them.
Welcome to the Good Life Central Oregon Podcast, where we pursue the good life by helping you pursue yours.
Goes out to our sponsor, RE/MAX Revolution and Sisters. RE/MAX is the number one real estate company in the world, and RE/MAX Revolution offers new solutions for better results. Go to ilovecentraloregon.com to find out more.
Welcome back to the Good Life Central Oregon Podcast. I want to welcome my next guest, Jason Bowerman. Good morning.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. We are in Bend, and we're going to talk about quite a few different things today. Among other things, music, building guitars, paddling. We'll probably talk about beer at some point. I can just feel it. But the first question I have right out of the gate, Jason, is how many hobbies do you have?
Boy, you know, living in Bend, living in Central Oregon, it's hard to keep them under control. You know, between the mountain biking and all the various outdoor activities, stand-up paddleboarding, kayaking, homebrewing. There's a lot.
Well,
Too many.
Well, of course, you know, we're recording this podcast in your studio right now, and walking through it, you have a quiver of kayaks. I would imagine you have a quiver of boards. I saw an unfinished bow down below and a finished bow upstairs. Guitars. It's easy to lose count in this place, isn't it?
It is. You know, I'm really fortunate to have grown up here in Central Oregon, and my dad took me out on the water when I was a kid and got me introduced to water recreation, mostly canoeing. And these days I kind of count myself as a canoeist, but mostly on top of the stand-up paddleboard. So that's part of it. Unfortunately, the kayaks have kind of been gathering dust lately.
Really?
Yeah.
So have you kind of given up the kayak career somewhat?
I've kind of given up on competitive kayaking. I still do it for fun, but I also find that sitting down in the kayak for any extended period of time isn't as comfortable as it used to be when I was younger.
Gotcha.
Standing up on the paddleboard is a little bit more my speed these days.
So you consider yourself a canoeist, and are you a reluctant supper, or?
You know, I kind of look at the SUP as sort of just a large standing up canoe, you know, and I also take my canoe out and stand up in that quite often.
Oh, really? You know, that's my limited experience in canoe, that's somewhat risky.
Yeah, for sure.
I bet that's a good training for, I bet subs feel like piers when you're, or barge.
You know, I have two giant Alaskan Malamutes, and I take them out in the canoe, and with the two dogs in the canoe, the canoe definitely feels really tippy.
I'll bet you're a good swimmer too then.
Try not to have to employ that skill as often, but yeah. Nice.
So with some of the research I've done, primarily through your website, thank you for rounding out the website with a ton of information. But you say that you were raised in the bottom of a canoe.
That's literally true, literally as true. I remember it, yes.
So let's start with that story. How were you raised from the bottom of a canoe?
Well, you know, some of my earliest memories are of my dad, you know, taking myself and then later my sister and I out fishing on the Upper Deschutes River. We were fortunate enough to grow up in the resort town of Sun River, and my folks both worked as employees of the resort. And my favorite thing to do, as I remember it, was to go out with my dad after he got off work, and we'd go fish for brown trout and rainbow trout down in the Deschutes where it has the confluence with Spring River.
About how old were you when this all began?
You know, I can't even remember. My folks have one story that they like to tell, that when I was still in diapers, I was really into looking over the edge of the canoe, and at some point reached for something and fell out. And while my mom was freaking out because I was floating away, head down in the water, being suspended by my diaper, my dad, I guess, calmly sort of just used the canoe paddle to fish me out of the water and put me back in the canoe. And apparently I've been after it ever since.
Interesting. I've never heard of a diaper being used as a life preserver as well.
Yeah, apparently it works, but it doesn't help keep the head out of the water, so it's probably not the best choice.
No, but babies can learn to swim, so I bet that worked out well for you.
Yeah, maybe that helped influence my, you know, it was my formative influence, but, you know, I've really enjoyed time spent on the water ever since. And, you know, my dad was also the naturalist down in Sun River, and so he was sort of in charge of teaching people about the great outdoors, and he spent a lot of time educating his two children about it as well. And we'd go out a lot in the evening and at night in the canoe and go observe the wildlife. And you see a lot more at night, believe it or not, if there's a decent moon the beavers and the otters and the mink and muskrat are all out playing at night, and we used to really love doing that. I still do that quite a bit.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, one of my favorite things to do, believe it or not.
So that's the nightlife in Bend is not in downtown. It's out there somewhere.
Yeah, if you're trying to get away from it, but still have that experience, yeah, you can get away from it all right in the middle of downtown Bend after the bar shut down.
Nice. So going from canoes, and then at some point you became a paddler and a competitive paddler for the U.S. How did that come about?
You know, I was really fortunate to have a number of great mentors in my life, and I met a fantastic fellow named Bob Breitenstein, who is pretty famous over in the Willamette Valley. There's a really famous surf wave spot on the Clackamas River called Bob's Hole that's named after him, and he kind of got me into my first whitewater kayak, which was actually a surf kayak. I didn't know it at the time, but he gave me a whitewater kayak, so I thought, which had a flat planing hull on it, which was really advanced for the time, and you know, I was using that to get onto the waves and play around out in the Deschutes River. And over time, a bunch of friends started competing competitively on the whitewater scene, which was just sort of coming into its own in the late 90s. And they went out on tour one year and came back and regaled me with all these stories of adventure and the rivers out east of the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And it really sort of sparked an interest in going out and seeing a little bit more of the world. And I think, you know, in the age of Aquarius, in your young 20s, you really want to go out and see it all. And so in those days, I was working for Breedlove Guitars already, but had the opportunity, just because things would get really slow in the summer for the guitar company, to take sort of a sabbatical or leave of absence and go out one year and try my hand at competitive kayaking. And I wasn't extremely good at it, but it was really fun. And it was a really neat adventure to go out and see all the different parts of the world, of the country, at least of the U.S., and check out the different rivers in California and Colorado and Asheville, North Carolina area. And I got pretty hooked on the whole competitive scene and kept working at it, and with a lot of hard work and over some time I worked my way up into it.
Now describe the competitive scene. I mean, you know, in other podcasts with some athletes and former professional athletes, we talked about the idea of competition, and of course there's the like a football competition where I beat you, I win, you lose type of thing. And then, you know, the type of competitions, single event, swimming, kayaking, I would imagine, where it's just you against the buzzer, you against the time, you against the course. What engaged you about the competitive side of kayaking? Since it's rooted in just adventurousness in the first place.
I think that's the core of it. You know, it provided for me an opportunity to go have a reason for exploring, you know, and sort of a structured format, you know, with a tour schedule that was out there, that, you know, the kayak competitions kind of went from venue to venue on different rivers throughout the U.S. And so it provided sort of a structure and sort of a framework for going out to check out these new and exciting places and new exciting rivers. As far as the competitions themselves, yeah, it's definitely a very individual sport where you're sort of always like looking to better yourself. Of course, it's a competition against other people. There's going to be a clear winner on the end of the weekend.
There's only one person at the top of the podium.
Yeah, and that's something fun to strive for and difficult to achieve. And at the same time, it's also if you're a highly competitive person, as I seem to be sometimes, it's always something that's really engaging. And to be honest with you, I was never a really high caliber freestyle kayaker in my own mind. You know, there are always a number of people here in the U.S., some of the best in the world, that were, you know, always sort of heads and shoulders above my skill level. But I worked at it hard and you know, eventually earned a berth on a couple of U.S. teams in freestyle kayaking. And that, to me, just getting on the team was a really big accomplishment, and I felt pretty good about that.
Well, especially, you know, since that, you know, years prior, that sport didn't exist in that format. So I would imagine that would be kind of an honor. But you sound either you're being particularly humble or would you say you're being realistic? Where would you place yourself in the spectrum? I mean, you just mentioned that that you were just honored to be part of the team and there are people better than you. I mean, that always seems to be the case. But then again, you did compete for the U.S. in kayaking. Are you just being humble?
Well, it's certainly true that most of the best freestyle kayakers in the world, you know, reside in the U.S., and that's less so true today than it was 10 years ago when I was doing the sport. But if you looked at the results at some of the world championships, you know, it was often the case that 5 or 7 of the top 10 results would be U.S. boats. So yeah, it was a challenge making the U.S. team, and getting to go, you know, compete internationally was a real thrill. And it's great to see the camaraderie that exists in the kayaking community off the course when you're not, you know, in the actual competition. You know, everyone's paddling together on the rivers and having a really good time. And there's a lot of lifelong memories that I made in those times that I'll still cherish, you know, from the competitions as well as the people I met.
And I've heard from other friends of mine who've been kayakers, paddlers, that competition or not, that's a tight group of people.
You know, there's something that comes from time spent on, you know, especially challenging or dangerous whitewater. And, you know, the sport of whitewater kayaking is inherently dangerous in some ways. And, you know, it's no more dangerous, honestly, than driving a car if you look at the overall risk assessment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there are times when, you know, when people's lives come into peril, and you're really relying on one another in a way that, you know, is probably not as common unless you've been to war or, you know, maybe been in other sort of expeditionary experiences. You know, the utter reliance that you would put your life on the line to help one of your brothers out is a pretty powerful thing that bonds people together in ways that, you know, normal activity won't.
Well, I think one of the other things that from the outside looking in, that it's one thing to get caught upside down in a hydraulic, but it's another thing to just acknowledge just the mere fact that everything is going really, really well with this trip. However, meanwhile, we are miles and miles and miles and miles away from the nearest help. And so is that part of the reliance on each other? Is,
yeah,
if something were to happen, you know, all you have is just your group.
You know, really well said. I mean, you're definitely looking out for one another, and you're sort of intrinsically understanding that you're caring for one another on those types of trips, and look, you know, you've got each other's back, and it's definitely, it changes your mindset when you realize that, you know, it's not just a roadside trip, but you're, you know, especially if you're on a multi-day sort of mm-hmm. more expeditionary type trip, you definitely, you know, you form much, much closer bonds than you would, I think, in many other sports, you know. And those are the roots of deep friendships, you know, where I've got friends that I haven't seen sometimes in years, but you know, you get each other on the phone, and it's just like that time falls away. It's pretty neat.
You just kind of have that moment of being out there, that kind of shared experience, both good and potentially bad, that kind of lock those souls together, I would imagine.
Indeed, yeah.
So where, well, real quick side question, where did paddling take you?
Well, I had a really good time here in the Pacific Northwest at first, when I was first getting into it, and then doing the competition circuit, I got to explore the rivers of California in some depth in the Sierra Nevada, and there's just an innumerable number of runs down there. There's just so many beautiful rivers in the Sierra Nevada. Also up in Washington State, and Colorado has a number of really amazing whitewater runs as well. And then for a couple years, I also traveled and competed on the East Coast a little bit, and so got to see a little bit more of Appalachia and sort of the Great Smokies, and they have a really different type of character over there in those rivers, and do some surf kayak competition. And that eventually led me to Brazil for a world championships event in Rio de Janeiro. So we got to see a little bit of Brazil, not much. It's a huge country and really expansive and beautiful, yeah. But that was a really neat experience. I also got to compete over in Europe in 2000 and 2001 and be part of some world championships and Euro Cup competitions over there, and see a lot of the really interesting, like, glacial rivers up in the Alpine regions. Some of the rivers over there are like milk. I mean, there's so much glacial till running down these rivers. It's really thick and chalky. It's really a strange experience paddling in that water.
I bet that would be kind of surreal.
Yeah.
There's one thing, you know, okay, clear rivers like, you know, that we have around here. And, of course, there's always that milky brown river that's just kind of, you know, looks like it's coming from Willy Wonka's chocolate waterfall, but
I assume you're talking of the Crooked River when referencing that color.
That would be one. My family and I just took a little trip yesterday, and we saw a little river along the side of the road, and we told them it was chocolate milk. They got all excited, but that was the image that came into my mind. But I have seen the Crooked River, and I would agree. So those are all the places you've been able to go. And so we fast forward to now. You kayak occasionally, it sounds like, and gotten into SUP. What are you doing these days with paddling?
Well, one of the new sort of challenges in life over the last few years has been You know, when I was over in Europe, we had the pleasure of surfing a lot of really neat artificial features, oftentimes located right in the heart of cities. Mm-hmm. Munich, Germany has a number of really amazing surf waves that are located right in town, the most famous of which is located on this canal, this industrial canal right in the heart of the city, and it's right next to the art museums and upstream of the English Garden, which is a very heavily touristed zone, so it's actually become a very well-known like tourist destination for people to go and watch the surfers surf the canal wave in downtown Munich. But when I came back to the States, I kind of realized, you know, there weren't as many of these artificial spots, and there were at the same time a lot of dams, and specifically we were looking at the Colorado Dam in 2001 and 2002 in downtown Bend, the Colorado Avenue Dam, mm-hmm. which formed the old mill pond, and realized, you know, here's sort of a blighted, outdated industrial hazard that, you know, really could be serving a much higher purpose if it were to be reconverted. And so a number of paddlers in the Bend community have been working on this project for about 12 years now to try to get the Colorado Avenue Dam reconverted. And it looks like it's finally really starting to come to fruition, which is really exciting.
And so here we are, just for sake of clarifying the dates, we're recording this at the end of October of 2014. And so when we release this episode, things will likely have changed. So what's the website where people can follow updates and see where things are when this releases?
So I'm part of a nonprofit organization called the Bend Paddle Trail Alliance. And that website is www.bendpaddletrailalliance.org. Mm-hmm. It's a 501c3 nonprofit. And in addition to, you know, working on the Colorado Dam, we've also been involved in getting the Deschutes River designated as a water trail, Oregon's only second water trail behind the Willamette River. And so we have about 130 miles of the Deschutes River that's been sort of designated by the national recognizing body as a scenic water trail. And we've also done a bunch of maps and signage projects. So it's kind of a neat organization in terms of what it's been trying to push forward in terms of recreational opportunity on the Deschutes River.
And so just for a quick clarification, you know, if, for anyone out there who is a paddler, I mean, this is just paddling dreams right now. You know, talking about surfing is just, you know, we're opening up a new spot. The waves are going to be fantastic. You know, it's just kind of that type of buzz. But what about those people who don't paddle? What does this mean to the area in general?
Well, one of the neat things is that it helps connect two of the most popular reaches of the Deschutes River. So even if people aren't, you know, active in paddle sports or in surfing, you know, we've seen a tremendous growth in the use of the river by people that are floating in inner tubes. And those people have had to get out and walk around this dangerous dam for the last few years. In 2005, there was a change to the Bend City Code that finally allowed, like, river recreation, which was previously illegal. Believe it or not, swimming in the Deschutes River used to be illegal under Bend City Code.
Yeah, I kept waiting for cops to come swimming out there to go arrest people, though. It never happened.
Yeah, that's a rare day when you see the police in the water.
Yes.
Hopefully they're doing a rescue.
Yes.
But since 2005, there's just been an explosion of river use, mostly by people using inner tubes to float the river. And it's one of the most popular things to do. People put in up by the Parks and Rec River Bend Park, mm-hmm. up by the Healy Bridge there, and then they float down. And then unfortunately, they have to get out and walk around the Colorado Avenue Dam. So part of the reconversion of the dam will be to create also a passageway for inner tubers that's safe.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that same dam is also very dangerous and has taken a life or two in the past decade or more.
Yeah, and right? we've been really fortunate. Jeff Frank, the owner of Tumalo Creek Kayak and Canoe, his operation is adjacent to the dam. It's only about 100 yards away, and he has, you know, heroically saved probably the lives of numerous other people,
really?
That have but gotten caught up in the dam. And I think, you know, quite honestly, if it weren't for his quick action and river rescue training, you know, there probably would have been greater loss of life there. So we're really thrilled that we're going to be able to reconvert this dam, you know, make it a safe structure, take out all the sort of, there's a whole bunch of like reinforcing riprap and rebar and, mm-hmm. and, you know, usually there's trees and other just sort of really ugly debris caught in the dam.
Bad things.
Yeah.
Just bad
that's
things.
All going to get pulled out of the river, and some artificial islands are going to be constructed, within which we'll have the Whitewater Surf Park with four waves. And there are going to be three channels total, one for the safe passage, one for the Whitewater Surf Park, and then a third channel that's dedicated to habitat. Mm. So it'll be there for fish and wildlife, and it'll also give children and anybody else that's into checking out wildlife an opportunity to see a little bit more riparian habitat up close and personal in that habitat channel.
So we're going to take something that's just old and flat out dangerous and turn it into something that's awesome and a little something for everyone.
I sure hope that's the outcome, and I'm really confident it's going to be something that Ben is really going to love. There's been a number of these projects that have been done in Colorado, and in Colorado we've seen incredible economic returns as well as part of these reconstruction efforts. A lot of the communities in Colorado are reporting multi-million dollar increases in economic benefit to the communities as a result of the projects.
Well, it's been years now since I've read this article, probably from Outside Magazine or something along those lines, but there was somewhere in Colorado they put in a water park like this, and the article was about not just the outside nature of the adventurous paddling, but what happened to the town afterwards and economics and the restaurants coming up and the communities that were built around it, just because this is where everyone was coming. And probably like in Munich, if you've got if you got a takeout where you can then just change your clothes and go to the nearest pub, someone's got to be there to serve beer when you're done playing in the water that day.
Oh man, that's so true. Probably the biggest transformation that I've seen has happened on the Arkansas River in Colorado in the towns of Buena Vista and Salida. And the river used to be the kind of place where people would, sort of the ne'er-do-wells would hang out and people would dump their trash. And once the water park was put in, and they also at the same time completed sort of a river walk, it absolutely transformed that stretch of the river, in downtown Salida, where now there's the most vibrant bar scene in the town is down along the river walk. All the shops fronting the river are really using that as sort of their focus. And you've got all kinds of, economic draw when you've got rafters coming to town, people that are using the Whitewater Park, mm-hmm. they're driving there specifically for that. And of course, like you say, the attendant nightlife is much enhanced from it.
Yeah. Yeah. Excuse me. That seems like there's just a lot of good things that are coming. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
Both selfishly and otherwise. I want to see how, I'm interested in seeing how that affects the general economics and converting more people into instead of just being floaters, being a little bit more engaged and doing something a little bit more challenging and fun. And of course, I also surf and driving to the coast for 4 hours, it doesn't happen all the time, but I always joke that the waves here in Central Oregon suck. Well, hopefully for not too much longer.
Yeah, in the Whitewater Channel, two of the four features are specifically going to be designed for board surfing.
Yeah.
So, there's a huge surfing community here in Central Oregon.
Huge.
Yeah, they're a little bit underground, but it's a huge number of people, and we're really hoping that we have something for everybody that, a couple of these features are going to be really fun for stand-up paddleboarders and for board surfers alike.
Yeah.
And, I think the greatest thing I'm looking forward to is seeing how it affects the youth culture. And, that's something that's really evident in Salida, for example, where the kids just didn't have a whole lot to do. And now, you go down to the Whitewater Park on any given afternoon and, more than half of the people that are down there will be under the age of like 18. And you see a lot of 12 to 15 year old kids that are out there, learning how to kayak, learning how to surf, boogie boarding, and it just gives them a really, really positive, athletic, self-directed adventure, mm-hmm. That also puts them in tune with nature and kind of gives them respect for the river. So what you've seen as an outgrowth of that is that people are really taking care of the river in a much greater capacity.
I can't wait to see that. So let's take a quick turn and follow a parallel course with this paddling. So while you were paddling and competing, you also took up I don't want to call it a hobby. You also began building things. Where did your passion and desire to build things begin?
I think that actually that started all the way back, just watching my dad, who was, sort of an amateur gunsmith, working on his rifles or model rocketry that we did mm-hmm. as kids. I've always loved hobby crafting things, working with my hands. But about age 14, I really started to feel this like really compelling need to start building things. And it started out in my interest with mountain bikes. I built a number of bicycle brakes and seat posts and clipless pedals and all sorts of things that weren't as commonly available back in the early 90s as they are today.
As in, building from scratch and designing and all that stuff? Or
yeah, I was fortunate my folks introduced me to a couple of great mentors, Bob Breitenstein, of course, which I mentioned, who was the guy that developed the Yakima racks, and he really helped me sort of like understand manufacturing. And a greater degree. And then, you know, that sort of led me into an interest in engineering, and I ended up actually going to Central Oregon Community College and studying manufacturing, welding, and machine shop skills there. Mm-hmm. I'm not proud to admit it, but I actually dropped out of high school to go pursue those dreams at the age of 16, and was probably the youngest person in their manufacturing program at the time. But after a couple of years at COCC, I also went off to Colorado State to study engineering, and found I didn't really like the engineering program, only because it was so theoretical and there wasn't enough like opportunity to do the hands-on, you know, mm-hmm. crafting of things. And I ended up switching my major over to industrial sciences tech ed, which is basically like being a shop teacher. And in that program, we had a class on bending wood, which kind of introduced me to a whole realm of artistic, you know, endeavor with wood that I'd never been exposed to before. And I kind of found the medium that I really fell in love with, and built a mandolin while in college. And when I moved back to Central Oregon, that's when I discovered that there was a guitar company, which had been founded here while I was away at college.
Yeah, who knew?
Yeah. And it was a pretty exciting opportunity for me. And I got an internship down there. And I think I recalled Steve Henderson, the owner of the company at the time, he stuck me on the bandsaw resawing this really kind of toxic wood called bloodwood for about a week straight. It's bright red, and I'd come home and I'd blow out these like red boogers every night.
Oh my goodness.
And I loved it. I guess like after a week straight of that, when I was still like, you know, wearing a smile on my face, he figured I was kind of in it for the right reasons. And
what company was this?
This was Breedlove Guitars.
Yeah. Formerly of Tumalo. Now they're in Bend.
Yep.
And so, did you start as an intern?
I did. I started as a college intern at Breedlove Guitars. And then, you know, after graduating college, I took a 2-month bicycle tour of Europe with a couple of friends. And when I came back, they were looking to hire somebody full time. And I jumped in with both feet and worked there full time for about 3 years. But those were also the days in which we were, you know, we were kind of slow in the summer times. And that's what allowed me to get into kayaking as well in a more competitive fashion.
Gotcha.
But the woodworking actually sort of preceded the kayaking.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So just let's bend some wood, and next thing you know, bing, bang, boom, you're making a mandolin in college.
Yeah. And then, you know, from that, having the opportunity to work, you know, to share a bench with Kim Breedlove at the Breedlove Guitar Company in an era in which it was a very small, very intimate operation. There were only 6 people there when I first started working, and, you know, we kind of were growing quickly, but, you know, to have that opportunity to sort of get in on the ground floor, so to speak, on a growing operation like that, and learn as much as I was able to at Breedlove over those years was really a great blessing.
So at risk of bringing a lot of the stuff to the or this conversation to an endpoint prematurely, it sounds like your success in your endeavors has really been due to finding great mentors and following what you were passionate about.
You know, I think
following that.
I think it comes down to 3 things. I think it comes down to early childhood exposure. When I look back in life, you know, I had a lot of opportunities. My parents always encouraged me with all these things and introduced me to everything that have later developed into my passions. The canoeing and the sort of the hobby, the craft woodworking.
Yeah.
Those all started really early, and I've loved them my entire life. And then, of course, finding great mentors, you know, finding people, being fortunate enough to find people that, you know, also could introduce me to a greater depth of understanding. And then, you know, like you say, passion sort of leads to just, you know, wanting to pursue things and staying with it and being persistent and being diligent. You know, I'll be honest in saying that, production guitar making isn't really the most glamorous of crafts. You know, there's a lot of hours spent just, you know, doing very repetitive tasks, you know, sitting mm-hmm. there at the bench, you know, putting tape on a guitar or scraping the guitar.
Well, yeah, I would imagine that, what a great conversation, especially in the Pacific Northwest, to say for someone who's a professional brewer, you know, that they brew beer, or someone who builds guitars for a living, you know, that they do that. But just from what I've seen, that there are a lot of things behind both of those businesses that, or both of those careers that can get a little monotonous at times, like hunched over sanding a piece just to get it to fit just perfectly. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, you know, I think that you have this great opportunity when you're doing these really repetitive tasks to sort of think about what you're doing. And I think that's one of the neat things about manufacturing. And I think whether it's manufacturing beer or manufacturing guitars, mm-hmm. you know, you find yourself, you know, doing a lot of things that are really repetitive. and you get to have a lot of time to theorize, and you also have a lot of time to hone your skills. I forget who it was that coined this term of, 10,000 hours to mastery, but
Malcolm Gladwell.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. That certainly applies in craft beer making or craft guitar making, and having that opportunity at Breedlove Guitars to sort of do things in a serial or repetitive nature, it could be mundane, but it also gives you the opportunity, if you give it that outlook, to hone your skills and develop your skills. And that's been a foundation to everything else that comes later.
And so you made a comment earlier that I took note of. It's kind of a concept that I've been kicking around my head for quite some time, the idea of finding freedom through structure. And it's kind of like a paradoxical idea. But anyone who is a musician or plays music knows that, you have that rhythm, you have that beat that forms that structure. And then from there, you can just take it off into outer space and back. Has that been a theme of kayaking and guitar building and music and all these other things, of finding freedom with structure?
I think for me, that's worked for sure. I think everybody's got their own approach to things. I like to use sort of a recipe, I guess, as it were, for building guitars. I've seen a lot of builders that have, just completely radical ideas, and a lot of times they're very interesting, but rarely do they sort of hit on all levels, of tone and aesthetic and playability. And so, there's been a lot of people that have come before us, and it's really true that there's not much new under the sun. So, I think we all have this opportunity as artists to sort of express ourselves if we have that freedom of time to do it. But building on the tried and true methods, I think are the easiest way to sort of have things that work well, because that ultimately is the goal of any musical instrument, is to sound beautiful and to be, visually striking, hopefully, and also to play well for inspire the artist that's going to pick it up.
And so how much of this comes into play as far as trying to hone a craft?
I think that you're continually working on certain elements of your craft, the mechanical elements of, really high quality fretwork, doing a really good sand out on a guitar neck before you put the lacquer on it. Those types of skills, you're continually sort of honing and trying to do the best you can and better, hopefully, than the last time, and learn from your experiences. But at the same time, it's an interesting challenge to sort of develop my own voice or my own point of view, especially now that I've started my own guitar company, branching off from Breedlove Guitars. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to sort of to find your own sort of point of view. I think there's plenty of people out in the world that do a great job of building Martin guitars better than C.F. Martin built them, mm-hmm. 50 years ago. I mean, there's a lot of folks that are sort of chasing that dragon, and I think that's a noble pursuit, because there's a lot of people that love those guitars and don't necessarily have the means to purchase something that's 80 years old, as those guitars have gotten really collectible and really expensive. And at the same time, I hope that there's also room for people to sort of, if not necessarily innovate, but at least, put their own sort of spin on things to develop the guitar, or their art in a direction that is more representative or reflective of their own personality.
Well, I think that's what I was trying to get at when I asked you about honing a craft, is, a lot of people will throw out the buzzword of, we want to pursue perfection, but some people don't explain what that means. What is perfection? What is your endpoint? How do you know that you're on the right path if you don't know where you're going? And it seems like for some people it's just trying to hone a process, trying to pursue that perfection, but without having that endpoint, where they're just trying to find a voice or find this character that just emerges and clarifies as they get closer and closer to it.
Yeah, I think I'll be honest in saying that I'm not sure that I see an endpoint in the development of like the Bowerman guitar, for example. It seems to be sort of an evolutionary process with some small baby steps, but I definitely have some concepts for some guitars that are, a little bit further off the beaten path. And I think that if you have seen the glass guitar, for example, that Susie Zeitner and myself have done in collaboration.
We'll get a picture of that for this blog post that goes with this. That was a beautiful piece of work.
Well, sometimes it's fun to be very far off the beaten path, but it's also, a very real acknowledgement that, finding people that respond, to art like that, who also possess the means to, or the willingness to use it in performance, that's maybe not as those two don't mesh as easily you know, glass guitars are kind of a scary thing. You know, you think, wow, if I drop this, I could break it, you know. And
yes,
that could happen, but it's also a really unique opportunity to just sort of express, you know, the guitar maker's craft in a very new medium and a sort of a new direction. And somewhere in between, you know, building guitars that are, you know, out of the mold of the Martin guitars and as far off the beaten path as a glass guitar, for example, lies a whole spectrum of different things that a person could do. And I have a number of different projects sort of percolating in the drawing board in the back rooms of my mind that I'm hoping to get to in the next couple of years.
Well, and I would imagine that the goal of Bowerman Guitars wasn't to create the perfect glass guitar, but just as a fun little side project. I wonder how many creative ideas that has opened up since.
Yeah, it's fun to kind of look at where inspiration comes from. And for me, I find a lot of inspiration in trying to sort of bring ideas from other fields or other interests into my guitar craft. I have a hobby interest in making knives, and I've brought some of the aesthetic of that into the world of guitar making, and it's been generally really well received. And even Breedlove Guitar has a model which features some of these mosaic pins, which are kind of a common aesthetic element in really high-end custom knives that isn't common in guitar making, but it's something that they, since in designing for them, they found a lot of success with. So I think that's kind of neat that we can all kind of pick and choose or gather from other areas to roll that into guitar making, or in my case.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm going to try and mesh all this, your story all together between, you know, growing up and just being exposed to so many different things. You've been a competitive athlete, you've been a paddler, you've been a waterman and a guitar maker and musician. How do you navigate between the mindsets? Are they, and actually the sub question is, are they different mindsets?
That's a great question. I think that the guitar making and the world of music really meshes well, you know, as far as how that ties into my love for the river and music.
Is this all honing a craft?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, over, you know, in your life's journey, you have your passion centers, whatever those might be. It might be snow sports. You know, I think living in Central Oregon, it's easy to have a lot of passions, but also, you know, the challenge is, of course, honing in on one or two that really, really are sort of the lifelong ones that are going to, you know, you're going to stick with. And so, yeah, I think you're constantly, you know, kind of evolving a journey with those, you know, and finding new ways to challenge yourself.
So with all of these things that you've done, and I'm sure there's many more that we haven't even touched yet. I mean, you mentioned knives. I'm looking at bows and arrows in your office, and bikes and all sorts of things. Are there life lessons that have emerged from all these experiences? Are there any guiding lights that have emerged from what you've done so far?
I think if there's one takeaway from my experiences with both competitive kayaking and guitar making and these other hobbies is persistence. I think it's, you know, it's really easy to fail in life, and really those failures are opportunities to learn from your experiences. And, you know, they're only going to hold you down as long as you let them, if you stay with it and keep at it and use those failures as an opportunity to better yourself and kind of reflect and learn from your experience, then we're all, you know, moving forward in our understanding.
Well, there are those I can't call them direct mentors, but people that I've read their stuff, and they talk about, you know, the best way to succeed is go out there and fail big, AKA go out and try, go out and do something. You're going to fail, figure it out, move forward, keep going.
I think one of the hardest things for business owners is to probably, you know, give their employees enough freedom to plumb the deep, as it were.
Yeah.
I remember early on at Breedlove Guitars, when I was first, you know, getting into doing finish work, I was doing like the finish sanding on a really high-end custom order that this client had placed with the company, and I ended up sanding the sides to like paper thinness, to where the guitar essentially had to be destroyed. It just completely, it was like about to fall apart, and I really expected I was going to get fired on that day. And the owner of the company, you know, kind of took me aside and said, look, you know, here's all the money I put into this guitar that we're going to have to cut up in the bandsaw here in a second, because it's not first quality anymore because of your failings. But this is what I want you to do to make it right next time. And you know, that trust and the willingness to like give me a second chance was really, really, that was crucial. I'm glad that.
Well, I would hope that there are more employers out there that would recognize that they just paid $8,000 to train this employee extremely well to never make that mistake again.
Well, that's
essentially what it comes down to.
I can't say that I never made the mistake again, but you definitely like learn from the experiences and you try to carry those forward. Yeah, and that's, it's a blessing to have that, you know, people that have that patience for sure.
What have been the high points of your varied careers so far?
Certainly in kayaking, getting to go compete at a couple of different world championships events, both in Spain and Rio de Janeiro, were real high points for me. And, you know, also some of the expeditionary trips. One of the really, really fun ones was I got to take a Indonesian boat ride trip, and we went and kayak surfed a bunch of these famous waves in the Mentawai Islands. And
oh, wow.
Just to have an opportunity to see that part of the world. And
I hope you took your surfboard with you, too.
You know, I wasn't a surfer at that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I hadn't really learned how to surf, and I've only come to it as an adult. I never skateboarded either as a kid, and that's one thing I've learned a little bit of, but I've also learned how hard you can fall on a skateboard, so yeah, I'm really cautious of it.
Especially when you're not a teenager anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Truth is, I'm much, much more comfortable with a paddle in my hand, so even in the ocean these days, I usually will be found out there on a stand-up paddleboard, and unless the water's warm and the waves are really perfect, I rarely get on a surfboard.
Fair enough. What have been some of the low points that you've experienced so far?
Oh, boy. I don't know if we really want to revisit them too much, but there were some tough times at Breedlove Guitars, you know, after the, you know, the recession of 2008, 9, and 10, mm-hmm. you know, things were really starting to become difficult for the company. And I think they're, you know, especially when there's a lot of money on the line, when you've sort of wagered and leveraged your passion for, you know, for growth, I think that can really color people's like decision-making. And some of the decisions that were made at Breedlove Guitars at that time were, you know, really hard to see happen. Yeah. And, you know, it was a really tough time and, you know, being forced to sort of make a decision to, you know, not be with the company anymore was, you know, that was a really tough decision, and it wasn't ultimately my own. And that's just kind of how fate plays it. And for me, that was a real challenge at the time, but I think it's ultimately led to a great outcome in terms of me being able to branch off into my own line of guitars. And they've found some reception now, you know, and people are starting to hear about the Bowerman guitars and starting to pick up on it. And that's been really fun.
That's true. To be a blessing in disguise.
Absolutely.
Because in that time, I mean, everyone went into survival mode.
Yeah.
Everyone went into survival mode. I was just fortunate that the work I did at that time was recession resistant. Let's put it that way. But there's a lot of people that, businesses and individuals, that had to make some hard decisions.
I think what a lot of us have learned from those times of 2008 to 2010 is that, you know, you really don't want to sacrifice, you know, your morals and your ethics and your family for money, you know. And I think that a lot of us have learned that, you know, it's more important to stay true to your community and to yourself than to try to, you know, leverage your dreams for, you know, a lot of growth, for example.
So then you grew up in Sun River, aka Central Oregon, but you've been all over the world. Was it just an easy decision for you to stay here because you grew up here? Or let me form that question a little bit better. You've been all over the world. Why have you chosen to remain in Central Oregon?
You know, there are a lot of great places out there and a lot of places, you know, that I could see myself living. But Central Oregon offers such an amazing array of different recreational opportunities. I mean, that's something that's been under my skin since I was young. You know, I probably unfairly, you know, had, you know, the opportunity to ride my bike as much as I wanted to when I was a kid or whatever that might have been. But yeah, how many places can you live where you can both, you know, be in the desert in 10 minutes, you know, from your house, and also be in the mountains with snow in 10 minutes, and mm-hmm. you have the High Cascade Lakes and rivers full of fish to fly fish or canoe or kayak and whitewater rapids. The list goes on and on and on.
Oh yeah,
it's a pretty special place.
And it's all pretty world class stuff. World class fishing, biking, paddling, and everything.
Yeah.
Skiing.
And even as Central Oregon grows and gets more populous, it's still possible to find, you know, people or places without people if you mm-hmm. are willing to spend a little bit of time looking and and searching and walking.
Yeah, unfortunately, all the usual suspects are no longer available for solitude, but it's still out there.
It definitely is.
It's definitely out there. So, Jason, how do you define and how do you live the good life?
I live the good life when I can get a good mix of work and play. To me, that that kind of sums it up. If I can work hard, you know, get some guitars built, and then also have enough time to go out and, you know, catch a powder day or catch a fish. That's a good week.
Is that would that also be the definition of a perfect day, of work a little bit here and go play a couple different places? And
man, I think the perfect day is bluebird skies on a foot or two of fresh powder in the morning, and you know, a good solid afternoon and evening of work in the guitar shop. Yeah. And then follow that up with some of the world-class beer that we've got at a pub with some friends. And I think that sums it up. That's the good life for me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that one for sure. Do you have any tips or advice that you would offer to those people who maybe they're struggling finding their piece of heaven, their piece of the good life?
You know, I think that one of the challenges, you know, especially in a place like Bend, which isn't the easiest place to find, you know, full employment, would be to just remember to focus on your passions and not worry too much about the money, especially if you're young. You've got time to, you know, make that happen later in life. And, you know, the big realization for me is that at least in guitar making, your earning potential really doesn't come until your 40th or 50th year of the craft. So you might as well just stay with it and continue to grovel along when you're young, and you can sort of deal with all the, you know, all the hardship of it. But stay with your passions and not worry about the money. And over time, if you follow and stay true to those passions, you know, you'll figure out a way if money's important to make that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think one of the things that I just got stuck in my head years ago was, if you want it, go get it.
Yeah.
And if you want it bad enough, you'll find it.
I think that's really well said.
Thank you. Real quick on Bowerman Guitars. Please tell us one more time the websites for the BPTA and Bowerman Guitars.
Oh, sure. The Bend Paddle Trail Alliance website is www.bendpaddletrailalliance.org. It's kind of a long one.
Yes.
Bowerman Guitars is a little bit long as well, but it's just www.bowermanguitars.com. So GUITARS.com.
And so we can definitely find them there. But just a little quick thing on Bowerman Guitars. How long has Bowerman Guitars been in existence?
It was founded in 2010, and so it's almost 5 years. And I'm working on the 64th guitar that's come out of the workshop right now. And so I'm doing about 10 to 15 a year and kind of growing that year over year a little bit, little by little.
And so, I mean, the way you describe it sounds like you're kind of a startup guitar builder, kind of getting some traction. But who has played your guitars of note?
Oh boy, I'm really fortunate. I was able to work for a number of really high profile artists while working at Breedlove Guitars. Mm-hmm. So I can't really count, you know, Madonna or Ben Harper, since they had Breedlove branded guitars amongst those, but I was really heavily involved in building guitars for some really famous folks while at Breedlove. But I'm really fortunate that Bert Lahms from the California Guitar Trio mm-hmm. has a Bowerman guitar, and I've built guitars for all of the California Guitar Trio over the years, which has been really fun.
And they were just up at the Sisters Folk Festival a few years back.
I believe so, yeah. Also, Kim Warner of the Green Cards has an instrument of mine.
Oh, cool.
Katie Curtis, who's a really beloved singer-songwriter who's performed at the Sisters Folk Festival, mm-hmm. has a guitar that I built for her. And she told me this summer at a concert that she's played nothing but her Bowerman guitar since getting it, which is a really great thing to hear. Yeah, and I've got a couple of other players here. Greg Spatz, who plays with John Reichman in the Jaybirds. He's got a tenor guitar of mine. That's kind of a neat four-string or eight-string style that not a whole lot of people in the world build. And I really love making those instruments, and I'm starting to see a lot more interest in those from other players as well.
And so if you go to BowermanGuitars.com, you'll see on one of the links, there's some videos, one from Ben Harper. Sorry, I'm a little biased on this one because I like playing slide, and he's playing one of your Weisenborns. And in the audience are the Obamas. Who else is in the audience? I'm trying to remember back. Bruce Springsteen was also listening. The boss is listening.
I think Maya Angelou was in the audience there. That was the Kennedy Awards, the Kennedy Center Awards or honors, and they were honoring Bruce Springsteen. And so Ben was playing a cover of his song "My Father's House" on this. And for the folks that don't know what a Weisenborn guitar is, it was a really unique style of slide guitar that was developed in the teens that featured a hollow neck. And it was sort of developed to embrace the emerging Hawaiian sound that was big at the time in the early late teens and 20s. And there are not a ton of folks that build those type of guitars either. I really love them. And I was introduced to the style by hearing Ben Harper and Ed Gerhard and David Lindley, all three sort of masters of the style in 1 year back in the late 90s. And Ed Gerhard has become a really good friend over the years. And he sort of pushed me into building the Weisenborn style guitars and gave me a really fine example of an early Herman Weisenborn guitar to study and sort of emulate. And so I've built a number. We built about 26 at Breedlove Guitars, and then I've built almost 10 here at Bowerman Guitars.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and those guitars are not just for Hawaiian music. They're for folk and blues and all sorts of stuff. First cousin to a dobro, right?
Yeah, the Hawaiian guitar with the hollow neck, you know, kind of preceded the dobros. The cone technique or method of construction kind of came a little bit later in the early 20s. Okay. And the dobros were so much louder in those days before amplification that they were much preferred, you know, for the big band sound.
Yeah.
And the Hawaiian guitar became a little less known. But they're, the Weisenborn styles are just phenomenal instruments, and they can cover so many different sounds.
Oh, really neat. And they just sound ethereal is a great way that I think of describing the sound of those.
Yeah.
Anyway, I could geek out on this stuff for far too long. One last thing I wanted to ask you about, or one thing I wanted to find out about, is you've done some work at for the Americana project.
Yeah.
But not, and I'm sorry, I meant to get to this sooner, but we traveled down a couple rabbit holes that were equally exciting, but the Americana project is a program at in the Sister School District for music and Americana music, but your role there is a little bit different. What have you done to help that education along?
You know, like I said, I was always interested in building things, and with a mind that, you know, a lot of kids haven't had the same opportunities to get engaged in making musical instruments, for example. Along with Tony Cosby, the woodshop instructor out there, we started a guitar making class at the high school in 2006, and we've been building guitars, and more recently they've also set up an ukulele program out there. So so I sort of serve as an advisor and volunteer instructor. I get to go out and I don't have to necessarily have a teaching certification, but I still get to engage in the industrial sciences tech ed that I studied in college at the through the Americana program out in Sisters. It's really special. It's one of my favorite things.
And it's because of you guys that me and many of my friends wish we could go back to high school.
Yeah, we keep talking about trying to maybe do an adult educational, sort of class for guitar building at some point. And it's tough because the summers are so full of other fun things to do, but hopefully we'll get it together one of these years.
Let's start into our rapid fire questions series, Jason. What is your favorite virtue?
Probably I'd have to say humility.
That makes sense. What is your favorite vice?
It's probably IPA.
A good one. What motivates you?
What motivates me? I guess I always want to do better than the last time.
And then what frustrates you?
Failure.
Ironically, since we just talked about how much value failure has.
There's a lot of value in it, but it's always a frustration. Yes. Yeah, no one likes to see a guitar hit the floor.
It doesn't mean you have to like it. Just learn from it. What guides you?
I see sort of a path coming down from the sky from from our ancestors, you know, to hopefully our children. And we all have a lot to learn from the folks that have come before us and sort of open the doors and pave these paths for us. So I try to live true to some of the qualities that my family have instilled in me.
Hmm. Then what distracts you?
Powder.
I'm guessing among other things.
Yeah, sunshine and powder, which are in, equal parts too much abundant, too much too much up here in Central Oregon.
Yes, we do have too much sun in Central Oregon, don't we?
Yeah, that's a shame.
I know, it's a terrible thing. What inspires you?
I'm inspired by the work of other artists, and hopefully I'm not stealing too liberally from them too often.
What is your favorite quote or verse?
It's too early in the morning for this, Jeremy.
I know. I blame myself.
You know, we might go to scripture and say, do unto others as you'd have done unto you.
That's always a solid one. Perfect. So this should be a tough question, I would imagine. And I'm being sarcastic. If you weren't a paddler or a luthier, what would you be?
I'd probably be a bicycle builder. Yeah.
Just from one passion to the next?
Yeah. I almost dove down that rabbit hole at one point in my life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then what do you hope to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well done, son.
Perfect. All right. Once again, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
My pleasure.